Police Court.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice Lemons, Justices of the Supreme Court. My name is Jason Rucker, on behalf of Vaughn Deontay Edmonds. The assignment of error that we are raising in this case is that the Court of Appeals erred when it held that the trial court did not abuse its discretion when the trial court denied appellant's or defendant's motion to withdraw his guilty plea. In this case, the defendant entered a plea of guilty to the charge of violent felon in possession of a firearm. Prior to sentencing, the appellant and the defendant filed pro se motions to remove counsel, pro se motions for a motion to withdraw the guilty plea. Ultimately, and before sentencing, new counsel was appointed. New counsel filed a subsequent motion to withdraw the guilty plea. A hearing was held on that motion, and at that hearing, there was a proffer of facts, which were not objected to by the Commonwealth. That proffer of facts included that police were dispatched to an apartment complex to be on the lookout for an individual that was threatening a man and woman with a gun. Police went to the apartment complex, and before encountering the defendant, police learned that the individual to be on the lookout was an individual by the name of Buffy Miller. While at the apartment complex, police heard a commotion coming from one of the apartments. They went to approach that apartment and saw the defendant leaving the apartment. They confronted the defendant, asked him questions. The defendant ultimately admitted that he had a firearm in his pants pocket. Defendant told police, and this was proffered at the motions hearing, defendant told police that he thought he was doing the right thing and was trying to take the gun so that Bumpy Miller could not get it and use it. Shortly thereafter, Bumpy Miller exited from the same apartment complex. There was also testimony at this motions hearing from defendant's uncle. Defendant's uncle testified that he was allowing defendant and Bumpy Miller to live in his apartment. And on this particular day, there was an argument, or the uncle testified that he heard an argument between Bumpy Miller and defendant. And during that argument, uncle testified that he heard Bumpy Miller tell defendant that he was going to shoot into or through defendant's girlfriend's apartment, which was in the same apartment complex, but across a grassy area of that apartment complex. Thereafter, defendant's uncle testified he saw defendant leave the apartment, and shortly thereafter he saw Bumpy Miller leave the apartment. Defendant sought to ask the court to withdraw the guilty plea that was made. This motion was made before sentence was imposed. Defendant argued that he had a viable defense of duress and that the motion was made in good faith. The trial court denied that motion to withdraw the guilty plea. Pursuant to 19.2-296, when a motion to withdraw a guilty plea is made before sentencing, generally ends of justice support the withdrawal of a guilty plea if the motion is made in good faith and upon a reasonable basis for a substantive defense. And that's citing to the case of Justice versus Commonwealth. Justice versus Commonwealth goes on to hold that a motion to withdraw a guilty plea should be granted even if the guilty plea was merely entered inadvisedly when the evidence supporting the motion shows that there is a reasonable defense to be presented. The Commonwealth, in its brief, relies upon the case of Pritchett versus Commonwealth for the proposition that a guilty plea must not only, a defendant must not only present a viable substantive defense, but that a defendant must also establish that it was done inadvisedly to the extent that counsel had provided erroneous advice, bad advice, or that counsel had overlooked a viable defense. I'm asking this court to reconsider or take a look at that holding, and I would suggest that the main purpose that the Pritchett Court, at least reading the black and white letter, Justice Kelsey, I know that you're a member of that panel. If I did not know that, Justice Kelsey, I would stand before this court and say, and I think what the court was trying to get at was making sure that the motion was made in good faith. But the Pritchett Court did say that there must be some form of facts presented to establish that the plea was entered inadvisably. I don't think the intent of the Pritchett Court and the Justice versus Commonwealth case intended to create a motion to withdraw guilty hearing and turn it into an ineffective assistance of counsel hearing.
But Pritchett did not equate any of this to a habeas corpus context. In fact, that's quite clear. It's not a habeas corpus context. So the truth be told, the original language we have from the beginning has some soaring remarks in it, but you have to apply it in real time and real cases. And the way trial judges do it is show me. You've got to show, you've got to present something on all these things. And the concepts like good cause, it's a very broad, equitable concept. Same thing with prejudice, and same thing with the timeliness points we've talked about. But can you, before we get too far into your time, can you address the point the Commonwealth makes that the manifest injustice standard really is better given the way the mandatory minimum kicked in prior to this motion being filed?
Yes, Justice, I don't believe that the manifest injustice standard, this more strict standard, should be applied to this particular case. And the reason I say that is because, well, the Commonwealth seems to support its position that it should apply because there was nothing left to do. There was a plea of guilty to a charge which carries a mandatory minimum of 5 years and a maximum of 5 years. Their position is that there's nothing left for the judge to do but impose 5 years. I would disagree respectfully with that position, and that if that was the case, the judge would not have continued the case out for a pre-sentence report. The trial judge, if that were the case, would not have continued the case out for sentencing. It's very clear that after a guilty plea, the trial court does maintain jurisdiction over the case.
Could the trial judge have suspended any of these 5 years?
Well, I don't know. No, Justice Kelsey, if the judge had refused to reconsider, if the trial judge, after upon looking at the pre-sentence report, had decided, yeah, I'm not going to reconsider the denial of the Stars or Hernandez's position, the judge would have been required to impose 5 years. But I don't believe that it's appropriate to speculate what the trial judge really intended, especially when the trial judge did continue the case.
Well, why wouldn't the question for us be what he intended, whatever it is, he couldn't have suspended the 5 years. And we just don't allow nullification by juries or, for that matter, sentencing nullification by trial judges unless the General Assembly delegates that power.
Yes, Justice Kelsey, that's absolutely correct. If the judge were to continue and refuse to grant relief pursuant to Hernandez or Starr, and if the Commonwealth likewise had not agreed upon reviewing the pre-sentence report to allow that type of disposition, we don't know what could have happened in the future because the trial judge did continue the case. There was no final appealable order just because there was a guilty plea entered. Mr. Edmonds had not been sentenced yet. We don't know what could have happened. So, although if the judge had continued to refuse to grant Hernandez a start of relief, or if the Commonwealth attorney had refused to allow that type of relief, come to some different agreement, then yes, the trial judge would have been required to impose 5 years. But we don't know if the trial judge was going to do that at that particular time when Mr. Edmonds filed his motion to withdraw guilty plea. It was still under the jurisdiction of the trial court. And when the Commonwealth is making its position that manifest injustice should apply, the Commonwealth, and nowhere in their brief do they maintain or suggest that a 21-day rule should also apply. And that's because this was not a final appealable order. And it did remain within the jurisdiction of the trial.
So your best argument is, even though maybe logically the timing should be restructured, the text of the statute requires the entry of the sentencing order, period. And if you haven't done that, you don't cross the manifest injustice line.
I believe, yes, Judge, and Justice Kelsey, I believe that is correct because it was not a final appealable order. It still remained within the jurisdiction of the trial court. And I think it would be, I would suggest that we would be speculating about what the trial judge intended, especially if you were to accept with the Commonwealth that's true, is that there was nothing left for the trial judge to do but impose 5 years. The question I have for the Commonwealth would be, well, why did the judge continue the case for sentencing? Why did the judge order a pre-sentence report? So I don't believe the manifest injustice standard should apply because there was a final appealable order. It still remained under the jurisdiction of the trial court at that point.
What do you understand the elements of the affirmative defense of duress to be?
Chief Justice Lemons, duress requires that a threat be made that produces a reasonable fear of imminent death or bodily injury, and the only means by which to prevent that imminent threat of bodily injury or death is to
commit a criminal act.
Commit a criminal act, yes.
Now, is that limited in terms of the to whom the threat is directed?
Well, the case law is clear that it needs to be directed to the defendant himself. And the Sam versus Commonwealth case also extended that to include family members of the defendant. In our brief, I did suggest that it should be extended to include third parties because of the public policy argument that it is in public policy's best interest that if there's a choice between two evils, that an individual should be inclined to choose a lesser of two evils. That means commit a criminal act to avoid the greater evil, which could be serious bodily injury or death to a third person. I think public policy supports...
To any third person?
Pardon me, Justin?
To any third person? Anyone?
Yes.
You're walking out of Walmart and there's this person you don't know, looks like a purse is going to get stolen. Commit a criminal act to protect that person? And you get the defense of duress?
No, Justice, Chief Justice Lemons, only if there is a reasonable threat of serious bodily injury or death to another person.
But
then
that, we're talking now about to whom that threat is made, and I'm trying to get the universe of people. And I think you're telling me there is no limit to the universe of people.
Yes, Chief Justice, I would suggest that there would not be a limit. If there is a reasonable threat of serious bodily injury to a third person or a reasonable belief of a threat of death to a third person.
So if you're watching TV and you see on the news that there's some riot going on in the city next to you and gangs are beating people up and you're a felon, you can arm yourself, go over there and help those poor people. Is that, I mean, it sounds ridiculous on the face of the way I say it, but is there anything about what you're saying that would say, no, that's not what I'm saying?
Well, it would still have to be imminent.
Okay, it's happening while you've got a 20-minute drive to get over there, a 10-minute drive, a 2-minute drive.
Well,
could you literally do that?
I think that would be a distinction. I think that I think in that particular situation, it wouldn't be an imminent threat if you're watching television and you see that there's a riot someplace else.
It is if you're watching real time and people are getting beat to the point of serious injury. Under the logic of, see, we have to test, as the chief is asking, we have to test all this as to where this could go. It's still unclear to me, as the chief asks, where is the outer boundaries of your legal universe to third parties?
Well, it would have to be a reasonable basis, first of all. And that would have to look at the particular circumstances of each case. And applying that standard to this particular case, my client knew Bumpy Miller. He was living in the same apartment with him. So he would have had an understanding of what his state of mind is and how he intended to carry through with his threats. So that's a reasonable belief. And it would also have to be imminent. With respect to the example that Justice Kelsey provided, I don't know if we could necessarily say that that's a reasonable threat just because a reporter reports it on television. But if an individual doesn't know the individuals that are making those threats, I don't think that situation would apply in that particular case because it would not be reasonable.
You're misunderstanding or dodging one of the two Justice Kelsey's questions. It's not all of those other aspects of the circumstances. It's to whom the threat is addressed. And you still come back to the universe as the whole world.
Yes, it is my position.
Now, in your understanding, is there a substantive difference between the elements for the defense of duress and the elements at common law for the defense of others?
I believe that it's very similar to self-defense and self-defense of others. I think the Commonwealth cited a self-defense case in their brief, and that was the Sands case, where it talked about self-defense. So it's very similar, and it would still have to be a reasonable threat of serious bodily injury or death, and it would also at the same time have to be imminent. Chief Justice, I still believe that it should apply to third persons as long as you can establish and show that it was reasonable. Reasonable based upon the facts of each particular case, knowledge about the individual. and that, it, that the threat was imminent.
But defense of others in common law is a defense to asserting force against someone to defend the victim third party. It has nothing really at common law to do with permitting you to arm yourself with something that in another law says you're not able to arm yourself with, unless you or your family members are in fact being attacked. Isn't that the distinction?
Well, the distinction, that's a duress distinction, in this particular case he had to, our position is that defendant wanted to retrieve the firearm so that Bumpy Miller could not gain access to that and potentially shoot through an apartment where his girlfriend and girlfriend's family were residing. There is a distinction between duress and defense of others. It would also... Thank you.
All right, your time has expired. Thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the court. Chris Chandler from Commonwealth. What Mr. Edmonds has argued in this appeal is that all he is asking this court to give him is the opportunity to present his reasonable defense at trial. But I would submit that what he is really asking this court to grant him is a free pass. Specifically, he is asserting that criminal defendants, solely on the basis of their ability to create a theory of the case or a story regarding the facts of the case that, if believed, would support a defense at trial, that that entitles a criminal defendant to be able to, if they think it might benefit them to do so, to enter a plea of guilty, to ask the trial court to defer disposition in hopes of ultimately getting that charge completely dismissed. And if that does not work out, the court denies that motion, then that criminal defendant, under Edmonds' theory, is entitled to say, well, I also have this reasonable defense, so now I'd like to withdraw the guilty plea and go back and give that a shot at trial. I would submit that that cannot be the law, it is not the law, it should not be the law. And in order to prevent this case from creating that type
of law... But that would
law,
be, as you say, if a defendant actually was gaming with that level of sophistication, you know, thinking that through as well as you did on the chessboard, that would clearly not be good faith, and a trial judge would be able to say, no, you're just not going to do that. But is that as clear here? It may be the effect of what happened here, but is it really that clear that the trial judge is thinking that, wow, that's a sophisticated maneuver you pulled, and I'm not going to let you to do that, as opposed to, this is just the way this weird case worked out?
I think that the best reading of the record, and of course, because defense counsel at the trial level assumed that all he needed to do was to proffer a quote-unquote reasonable defense. And he didn't have to show that it was entered inadvisably. He didn't think he had to show any sort of manifest injustice. He assumed all he needed to do was proffer that reasonable defense. Because of that, we don't have any real evidence to show what was in the mind of the defendant and what kind of conversation had occurred with counsel at the time he entered that plea. But I would submit that the best reading of the record in this case is to conclude that counsel and the defendant made the reasonable decision in light of the facts of the case and what may or may not have been a defense that may or may not have worked at trial had they submitted it to a jury, decided, well, we'll enter a guilty plea in hopes that maybe this trial judge will show some mercy and defer disposition and maybe we'll end up getting the charges dismissed completely. So the defendant took that risk as opposed to taking the risk of going to trial and submitting an affirmative defense that would have required an extension in this court's case law in order for the court to accept it or the fact finder to accept it.
Isn't that the narrowest ground here from your perspective, is that we've never extended it to third parties as broadly as is being requested, and it certainly is not the case where it's that compelling an argument that we should. If that's true, then it almost resolves every other issue in the case, does it not? It's not under any standard. Paris, post-sentencing, you have to show a viable defense which legally could be believed, not some jury buying it on nullification grounds, but legally would be appropriate to consider.
That's correct, Your Honor. That ruling by this court would resolve this appeal.
Counsel?
Yeah, Counsel, you've got the issue, though, is that the Court of Appeals has already gone beyond family. In Sam's, it was a fiancé. There's no legal status for fiancé. No definition of fiancé. A fiancé is not a family member. What's the distinction between a girlfriend and a fiancé?
Well, I do think that there is, at least in the minds of my own experience, that there was a distinction between my girlfriend and my fiance. And I think in common terminology, there's still...
Is a fiance a member of a family?
If the Court of Appeals decided to include a fiance within its definition of family member, then it was perfectly entitled to do that. But I do think it would have been one step further to also include a girlfriend within that definition from common experience.
I laugh because I've just been reminded that there is a song about putting a ring on it.
There are such songs, and such things still do matter to many people, including myself.
Counsel, yes, can I ask you, have you finished answering Justice Min's question?
I hope that I have.
Okay. I may have to withdraw the question.
Okay. The question that I have, though, and clearly the Court of Appeals decided that there was no, or decided the case on the fact that Miller's threat was not an adequate threat of harm, was not imminent.
Yes, sir.
Then doesn't that presuppose, isn't that based on, at least on the inference that had there been an imminent quality to the Court of Appeals would have ruled differently? In other words, that the threat to the girlfriend or to the uncle would have been sufficient if it was imminent.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think trial courts and appellate courts are entitled to make a ruling based on grounds that are dispositive of that appeal, and if making that ruling disposes of the entirety of the appeal by itself, there's no necessity to go one step further and address other potential grounds.
Well, but if you say the threat wasn't imminent, aren't you assuming that the threat made to the uncle wasn't imminent? In other words, the person to whom it was made was legitimate. If the threat was imminent, the decision would be different. I mean, doesn't that assume that the Court of Appeals is approves of a threat to a third party as a basis if it's imminent?
I think I would respectfully disagree. I think courts often write in their opinions, assuming without deciding X, we're going to make the decision on these grounds.
But they didn't say that in this case.
They did not say that. But they also did not address whether or not this doctrine could be extended to non-family members at all. So I would submit that effectively and implicitly they're saying, assuming without addressing whatsoever, the argument failed because the threat here was not imminent, it was not immediate.
But you did not raise any argument here that a threat to a third party would not be considered under the defense that he's trying to raise here. You didn't argue that here.
Correct, Your Honor. I did not argue that on brief because in my position, I think there are stronger arguments for why this case fails on those grounds. However, if the court feels like that is the best and narrowest grounds, that argument is still before the court under this court's right result, wrong reason doctrine in Perry. It doesn't matter whether or not the argument was raised below, either in the trial courts or in the appellate courts. If that is the best and narrowest grounds, this court is still entitled to rule on those grounds.
So in your cascading right answers, the highest right answer is what?
My primary concern in terms of the harm that a decision against the Commonwealth in this case could lead to in the big picture is that it would allow defendants to essentially game the system by concluding that all they need to do is to be able to come up with a story or a theory that would, if believed, support a reasonable defense, and that by itself is enough to allow them to plead guilty, ask for a deferred disposition or some other kind of relief, and then go back and withdraw that and then go to trial. And so that's why I've asked for this higher standard to be applied in this context to prevent that from occurring.
How do we get there, and let me just ask this question. Did you finish with your answer? How do we get there, counsel, with a clear statute that uses before sentence and after entry of final order as the two dividing lines?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the Court of Appeals decision in Pritchett is the best commentary on the answer to that question. And what the court stated there, and which I agree with, in reading the statute, the General Assembly has given the standard to be applied in cases where a sentence has been imposed and the motion to withdraw is made after imposition of sentence. What the Court of Appeals recognized in Pritchett, which is absolutely true, is that the General Assembly did not give a standard for courts to imply before that imposition of sentence.
Having given one after sentence, wouldn't that indicate that it would be different before sentence?
I don't think that it would, respectfully, Your Honor. I think that it only shows that the General Assembly made a decision not to answer that question themselves and to leave that question to be answered by trial courts and appellate courts. And because the policy reasons that this court has identified behind that manifest injustice standard apply equally in this particular context as they do after that sentence has been imposed, I would argue that it is perfectly consistent with the General Assembly's expressed intent to conclude that in this narrow class of cases, where a defendant knows exactly what sentence he's going to receive when he pleads guilty, and then coupled with that, after entering his plea, moves the court for some alternative disposition. In this case, he moved the court to defer disposition under STARS, and then hopefully at some point, perhaps after community service had been done, to dismiss those charges, and the trial court denied that request. Once that has occurred, that defendant knows exactly what sentence he's getting. He's been denied the only type of affirmative alternative relief he could have hoped to have gotten. And so without some evidence, his ability to show some manifest injustice that led to him making that decision, I would submit that he should not be allowed to withdraw that plea just because he shows that, well, there's this other defense that I think might could work, and I'd like to try that now.
Well, counsel, I understand the policy argument that you're making and under the circumstances of this case, but the Commonwealth at trial never talked about the standard of manifest injustice. The Court of Appeals didn't mention manifest injustice. This particular standard is not one that has been part of this case at all until you filed your brief.
Yes, sir.
Why would we even want to discuss it when we've got a record before us and assignments of error before us and trial testimony before us that talks about other issues which are equally dispositive of the case? How do we get to even address your...
Well, again, under this court's doctrine in Perry versus Commonwealth, I think that that avenue is still on the table before the court, which is why I presented it. And if the court determines that that's the best grounds, then that is the avenue that the court should take. However, if the court feels like it's not the best grounds, under the lesser standard, as I've argued on brief, the court should still hold that the trial court in this case did not err. And under that argument, under that that standard, I would ask the court to affirmatively adopt and approve the reasoning of the Court of Appeals in Pritchett versus Commonwealth. Because in that case, what the court said was it surely cannot be enough for a criminal defendant to be able to come to court and say, well, now I have this theory, now I have this story that supports this reasonable defense, I'd like to try that before the jury, and then that by itself entitles him to withdraw his plea. In Pritchett, the court said even under the lesser standard that applies pre-sentencing, going all the way back to Paris and following up all the way through the court's case law, this requirement of showing that the plea was inadvisably entered is a requirement that the courts consistently talk about. And so Pritchett interpreted this court's case law to stand for the proposition that a defendant under the lesser standard needs to show that his plea was inadvisably entered, that his motion to withdraw was in good faith, and then also that he has a reasonable defense. In this case, opposing counsel and Edmonds throughout has never argued that the plea was inadvisably entered. In other words, he's never argued that he was not fully aware of this alternative possibility of a defense when he entered his guilty plea, and then later decided he was going to move to withdraw it. If he had put on any evidence, if he had an affidavit from original counsel or a call of counsel to testify and could have shown that the time he entered that guilty plea, we had no idea that we might have a viable defense, perhaps that would be enough evidence to meet his burden to show that his plea was inadvisably entered. There was not even any attempt to do that because the assumption from the defense was, as long as I show that I have a reasonable defense based on what I claim happened, that should be sufficient. And for the same reasons I'm arguing that the manifest injustice standard should apply, I would also argue that the court's not willing to go there. The court should at least hold that there is an inadvisably entered requirement that has been with this court's case law since Paris, and that requirement applies pre-sentencing, and that because there was no effort whatsoever to meet that requirement here, because there's no indication on the record that the plea was inadvisably entered, that even before we get to whether that defense is reasonable or not, the defendant has failed to meet his burden to show that the trial court was required to allow him to withdraw his plea. If the court, of course, finds that he's not met his burden to show that it was inadvisably entered, then the trial court did not abuse its discretion. However, the court assumes without deciding that perhaps he could have shown that it was inadvisably entered, the court would, of course, then reach the question of whether or not that defense that he's offered is reasonable. As I've argued on brief, he has not met his burden to show that this was a reasonable defense. The defense relies on the Court of Appeals decision in SAM, where in that case the court interpreted the word imminent to mean something less than immediate. And as this court later held in Sands versus Commonwealth 10 years later, that definition for imminent is much too broad and much too soft. The word imminent means immediate. Sands was in a self-defense case, but if you go all the way back to the common law, as I cite on page 35 of my brief, repeatedly in this particular context, the word immediate has meant something, or the word imminent has meant something akin to immediate or instant or unavoidable. In this particular case, the trial court held, as the trial court found, the best that his evidence and his proffer, the best that it got was that this person who was threatening harm and made vague threats about the defendant's girlfriend, in order to carry out those threats, he would have had to have gotten a gun, walked downstairs and outside his apartment down the stairs, walked across a grassy area, and then walked into another apartment to then shoot into this other apartment.
Counsel, there's a couple of facts that I really wasn't looking for when I first reviewed this that your answer just now brought into question. Whose apartment was it where Miller and Edmonds were arguing?
Based on the stipulation, there was some confusion at first. That was clarified by the defense counsel that it was the apartment with the girlfriend where Mr. Edmonds' girlfriend lived with his family, lived with her family.
And where was the gun before Mr. Edmonds took possession of it?
I don't believe that is in the record.
Go ahead.
The claim may have been that the gun was somewhere in the apartment where Edmonds and Bumpy Miller were living with the uncle, and that Edmonds got it and then took it out of the apartment.
Okay, and no evidence in terms of whose gun it was?
Correct, Your Honor, as far as I know.
So may I ask one last question, Chief?
Absolutely.
So under that factual analysis, if Miller were advancing to pick up a weapon, or if Miller said, "Where's my handgun? I'm going to take care of this right now," we'd be into imminence territory there, probably.
If the threat at that time was still against someone who was in some other building across a grassy area, right. I would submit that that's still not instant.
So imminence would be, I'm going after the weapon, and I have an imminent time frame that I can actually use it.
Imminent would be immediate or instant. That is the threat of harm. It's immediate or instant. And Blackstone talks about that. Bishop
talks about that. Of all the debates we've had this morning, isn't that the narrowest and best ground within the cascading arguments you have?
If the court concludes that that's the narrowest and best grounds, I would be satisfied with that conclusion. Unless there are any further questions from the court. Thank you, Your Honor.
This session of the Supreme Court of Virginia is now adjourned.
All right.